Save big on everything for your next outdoor project when you shop at Menards. Greenworks 40-volt cordless tools have everything you need to keep your yard looking great. The Greenworks cordless trimmer and edger is lightweight, starts instantly, and comes with a 40-volt battery and charger. Pick one up today, on sale, now through June 1st. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money
at Menards. In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
You're listening to Power Athlete Radio, a podcast dedicated to empowering your performance every damn day. Join former NFL pro and Power Athlete founder John Wellborn as he dissects the greatest minds in strength, conditioning, and more. So whether your goal is to be the hammer, destroy mediocrity, or simply move the dirt, you've come to the right place. Now with the warm-up done, let the gains begin.
Henry, okay. Abbott, thank you for coming on Power Athlete Radio to discuss your new book, Ballistic, which thank you very much for sending over. I actually had a chance to go through and read, and I'll just tell you, I didn't finish everything, but skimmed through it and hopefully put some pretty good questions together, and we can talk about injury and science. And I'm actually very interested in what the guys at 3P are doing. Let's get in. I mean, I'd just like to start with a few questions for you. I mean, you had a long career as a journalist covering the NBA. How did that kind of set the tone for this book? I mean, with injuries, I come from the NFL, so I think NBA players are a bunch of fucking prima donnas. So as you were talking about all these injuries, I was like, dude, first of all, they fly around on private jets. There's four or five of them. They like, you know, travel like this. I mean, I realize their knees are a little banged up, but like the game is not what it was 20 years ago. I mean, I was watching some Larry Bird clips. Because to this day, I still think that era of like Bird and Magic and Jordan and those guys and that, I mean, was so much more physical. So now I watch the NBA and I'm like, God, these guys are so like soft compared to what their predecessors were. So I'm interested to get your take, and especially as a reporter and somebody that covers the NBA.
I just want to say, like, from like a 30,000 foot perspective, that is the perfect beginning of Power Athlete Radio. Right? You're just like, that is a total power perspective right there.
Well, I feel that, you know, we fail at the margins of our experience, and my experience as a 10-year NFL player was like, you know, I played in Philly. I mean, you know, we'd go up and play New York and play in these fucking games where we were literally like 3 yards in a cloud of dust. But then also, you know, Philly being like, you know, such a intense like sports town, and the Sixers and this, I mean, it's just, you know, we used to go to Flyers games. It just was kind of tough. And, but I mean, injuries are such a part of professional sports that it's, yeah. You know, but now with the rise of strength and conditioning, and there's so many different people, unfortunately, that are so full of shit in this fitness place, or, you know, performance landscape, that really the function of this podcast has always been battle the bullshit, and just me totally. Just kind of pointing fingers and being like, hey, man, I don't necessarily know what you're doing, but I don't think it's working. Or is it? And, mm-hmm. you know, being able to have people on the podcast that are coming in with an interesting perspective has always been my desire. So.
Yeah, so I think I've listened to several episodes of this podcast, and I find it's like, it's very aligned with the way they think at P3, right? They're battling the bullshit too. I think you guys would nod along so many things.
Their training is very similar to the stuff we do. I mean, yeah. It's a lot of post-activation potentiation, a lot of movement through space, like the way they define athleticism and the technology. We use some force plates, but like their tech stuff is really good. They're out in Santa Barbara, aren't they?
Yeah. That's the headquarters, and they have one in Atlanta too.
So I've when I lived in Orange County, I had got connected with one of their guys and was trying to go up there to kind of see what they do. I've always had a ton of respect for at least everything that I've seen from the optics from the outside. Like, these guys are really switched on, and I feel a lot better when I see somebody kind of come out of that stable, some of the other stuff I see.
And there's another part of it. So I can tell just from listening to this podcast that you have read everything and studied everything. But there's also this kind of playful element where, like, you know, hey, you just got to, like, get in there and do some stuff. And like, they're like that too, right? There's a lot of, like, mostly your body's super well designed and it can take a lot. It can take a lot more than you think, and you should push it and you should test it and you should see what you can do. And so I feel like there's like, just from my time listening to this, I'm like, oh, this is like, you guys have read a lot of the same academic studies. You've read the same books. And to honestly, to talk about your point that NBA players are soft today, my first thought is I want to talk about Yuri Verkhoshansky, who I bet you know a fair amount about.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So let me just tell this a little bit. I don't know much. You know more about it than I do. But let me just, this one little part I know is, you know, he had these triple jumpers and he was doing some simple math and he figured out that like in the last time they put their foot on the ground before they fly, they were using 300 kilograms of force because you can do the math of how far they fly and how much they weigh.
Sure.
But none of them could lift 300 kilograms in the gym. And he's like, that's weird, right? It's weird that they blatantly can push that hard on the ground. But if you put a bar across their back, they cannot lift anything like that. So the first day he tested it with just doing like a half squat to see if maybe that would get them closer. And it did. It got them a lot closer. And then he's like, okay, well, now maybe we'll do an even shorter range of motion. But the next day, none of them came in because their backs were killing them because they had lifted way too heavy, right? So he's like, well, that doesn't seem like the answer. Then he tried a thing where he had them lie on their back and they'd hold the bar across their feet. The coaches wouldn't. They'd push that way. Mm-hmm. Didn't really work. Eventually, he learned that it's because of the short time on the ground, right? You're carrying force from the approach into the explosive movement up. And that's why they have much bigger forces from this explosive movement than from lifting weights, right? So this was he called it the shock method, right? He started training this like super strength method. We call it plyometrics. And P3 now is, you know, more than a decade in having force plates in the floor. And they're finding the same thing, which is the biggest forces human bodies encounter are being in free fall, right? And when you hit the ground, one NBA player stepping off an 18-inch box landed with 11,000 newtons of force. That's triple the force necessary to fully sever a human spine. So these are the massive forces. This is how non-contact injuries happen, right? Is from these forces. So I think it's like a little trick in our brain where it looks like the toughest things human bodies face is like the guy wrestling you. But in fact, the biggest force is akin to a car crash, right? Is just you jumping high and then landing.
Mm-hmm. No, what we know in terms of like plyometrics and jumping, I mean, there was always a gold standard of twice body weight back squat as like kind of like the basis. That was kind of like, at least when I started many, many years ago when I was running track in high school. And we started like experimenting with plyometrics and depth jumps. And as the training got more advanced, there was always this idea that a double bodyweight back squat was just the tip of the iceberg, the scratching of the surface for people being strong enough to be able to protect themselves with plyometric movements. But mm-hmm. then we would see people that were, you know, extremely explosive. I mean, high jumpers, triple jumpers, all these different athletes that didn't have a double bodyweight back squat. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. that was always a little confusing for me. Where is strength the greatest replicator? I mean, if you've watched anything, I mean, people will get stronger or people will run faster if they get stronger right up until the point that they don't, which is from Charlie Francis, where strength is not the determining factor for speed. And it's central nervous system efficiency, you know, your ability to put your foot in the ground and go vertical position. I mean, it's so many factors into this. But the non-contact injuries, I mean, you know, my favorite one is always the RG3 moment where he goes and puts his foot.
I hated that moment, man. I hated that so much.
Well,
didn't you feel like you knew it was coming too?
Yeah. It's because he hired like his local cousin or his buddy to come train him. And they didn't understand anything about foot position, that when you go change in direction, if the toe is forward or the knee tracks over the instep, you can absorb and reduce force and reapply it to the ground to move there. His foot was out. His knee was over his knee, and all of a sudden, all those forces went in, and he blew his knee out. I mean, it's just the fact that he had been so gifted for so long, and this is one of the talks, actually, we used to give at a seminar when I taught for CrossFit. It was called the Curse of the Gifted. You cannot design training programs around the world's best athletes, because everything they do well, and that's the reason they're the best athletes. And now, if you can take somebody that's absolutely terrible and put them into a training system that allows them to foster and develop athleticism, be better, that's a greater representation of like the quality of your program, rather than just sitting around with a bunch of pro athletes and being like, okay. Because I saw it. I mean, in an NFL weight room, the goal of the strength coach is don't hurt anybody. You know, right. You're paying that guy $500 million. Don't hurt him in the weight room. And that's not really human performance. We interrupt this episode with a shameless self-promotion. Are you a field or court sport athlete looking to dominate the leaderboard? Let me introduce you to Field Strong. Take your inner athlete to the next level by exposing yourself to the advanced training techniques that contributed to my 10 years in the NFL. Unlock pinnacle performance and level up your athletic potential today. Head to powerathletehq.com/FieldStrong and claim your 7-day free trial. Now back to the show.
It's not getting any better. Yeah. There's actually a funny, two of the first NBA players to go to P3 were from the Jazz, Ronnie Brewer and Paul Millsap. Ronnie Brewer had like an electric, you know, ready for the NBA body, and he'd never had any problems. And Marcus Elliott, the founder of P3, was like, you know, that's kind of a curse, as your talk is themed, because it's like learning to drive in a brand new BMW, right? He just didn't believe in maintenance. Whereas Paul Millsap was too small for his position, took him half an hour to warm up. He had a creaky back and creaky knees and all this stuff. But he, if you put work in front of him, he would just do all of the work. And like the punchline is that Paul Millsap had a much longer, more successful career and made tons more money because he just kept doing all the work, right? And that's more like us, right? That's like me. I don't know about you. You might be more like Ronnie Brewer, but
If I had never lifted weights and I hadn't start kind of obsessively training, one, I don't think I would have got where I was. But two, I mean, obviously I had some genetic gifts. I'm almost 6'6". Like I think I'm a hair under, you know, and I'm 300 plus pounds or, you know, I played at 310. I probably weigh like 270, actually 272 today. We started doing a little bit of like a kind of a fitness challenge deal. One of the guys that we train with, I train some professional jiu-jitsu guys, and one of the guys needs to cut some weight. So we were like, ah, we'll do it as a group. So, so we started on that fight, but, the genetic gifts, but honestly, it really just came down to like, to training. For some reason, and this is just personal to me, every time I went in the weight room and I got stronger, I was able to do something better. I saw it translate out to the field. But what was wild to me was there were a lot of guys that I watched get stronger in the weight room that actually got worse on the field. Yeah. And so this was always like the Neo, you know, the splinter in the mind of the Matrix. Like, why do some people use everything that, you know, all the gifts, everything that they can hone, like the, you know, sharpen the blade, the proverbial, you know, analogy. Like, why is it when they sharpen the blade, can they go out and cut so much more efficient on the field and other guys go out and they just get worse? And that was where I realized that the training had to be representative of what you were doing on the field or the court or the pitch or the mat. And if you can't see translation, then you got to throw it away and start over. That if you continue to do the same things over and over again, you know, definition of insanity, expecting a different response, you just end up being worse. And you know, but also, and the reason I did like your book is, you know, you're standing on the shoulders of giants. I've always said, you know, like the early conversation I had with, you know, Charlie Francis and working with Mauro De Pasquale and, you know, Todd Rice and all the different, you know, Rafa Ruiz, all the people I've worked with, I'm just a culmination of a lot of really good coaches that happened to find me right at the right time.
Yeah. Yeah. So let me read you this quote that I love. Oliver Sacks is like a famous deceased neurologist. I don't know if you've come across his work before. Great writer. So much more of the brain is devoted to movement than to language. Language is only a little thing sitting on top of this huge ocean of movement. So this is kind of how I see what I learned from hanging around in P3 is, you mentioned like neuromuscular coordination and RG3, I put his foot down, right? This is what they're worried about, right? So there's a giant part of our brain which controls the 600 muscles that we have in our body, and it works similarly to the part of our brain that uses language, right? So you can think of it in terms of fluency and vocabulary, right? So if you grow up with someone chucking you a football as you jump off the diving board and you learn how to twist through the air and catch it, like you're adding vocabulary to your movement, right? That's a thing. And some people don't have that, right? Some people just will never be able to do that. This is why I feel really lucky. I grew up kind of romping around, biking through 100 acres unsupervised with my buddy Chris, and we would jump off things and dare each other to do weird stuff and try to catch wild animals. And we just got to move a lot. And I feel like, you know, I'm pretty comfortable in different environments because I have a pretty good vocabulary because of that. So
I call it the language of movement.
Yeah,
language of movement. Yeah, exactly, the language of movement and athletic problem solving. Yeah, like you take a kid to a tree and you're like, I want you to climb the tree, or you know, climb this fence or do these things. So you set up these little problems and you let's see how people navigate them and how quickly and easily they navigate it is a great indicator of how fluent they are in the language of movement. This episode of Power Athlete Radio is powered by Train Heroic, the most immersive strength training app experience on the market. We've built an online training business by partnering with Train Heroic to deliver all of our world-class training programs like Jack Street, Hammer, Field Strong, and Grindstone. To learn which Power Athlete training program best suits your goals, head to powerathletehq.com/training. And if you're a coach looking to build a business with the best training tech in the business, head to trainheroic.com/powerathletehq. And now back to the show.
I love this. So this is what this book is really about, right? Is that, you know, people come in and sometimes they have a weakness, right? Sometimes they have an unstable hip that needs more musculature around it, or they have The muscles of the lower leg, the soleus, gets a lot of attention because they're very concerned about your foot position on landing and having a stiff ankle so that your Achilles can absorb the force of landing. So there's some people lifting heavy weights. They're doing hard workouts in there. But the big obsession is this neuromuscular coordination. You know, can you land with your ankles, knees, and hips in something of a line and all flexing in time together, right? If so, you can absorb these massive forces. And the therapies for that include this thing that they have three of them. They built them themselves called, they call them impulse boxes. And it's like flat plywood across the bottom and then 45 degree angles on the side. And you basically dance. You like pop on one leg and over here and over, and you just try to go 10 seconds accelerating as fast as you can in like a dance step until you can handle it no more. And you're just getting your brain to be faster, 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 and having a good bouncy slap of the ball of your foot on the floor. There's my favorite. There's a video on their website, on the Instagram of P3, of Christian Ramirez, who I think was like a UCLA football player, maybe mm-hmm. played in the NFL, I'm not sure. He's moving his feet like a bazillion miles an hour across that impulse box, and his face is just relaxed and calm and happy. And like that's what I picture when I'm trying to be like fluid with my feet, right? Is moving like Christian Ramirez.
Yeah, no, I mean, what I do like, and like kind of like the hallmark for me whenever I evaluate somebody's training is like, and I know this sounds super hokey, but I always look for a balance of like bilateral and unilateral movements. Mm-hmm. You know, are they moving in three planes of motion? Is it sagittal, frontal, and transverse? And then are they actually taking those three different planes and these different bilateral, unilateral movements, and are they mixing them in interesting ways? And are they finding unique ways to load them? And then more importantly, are people moving well in such a way that it's pleasing to the eye? So I came up with a definition of athleticism years ago, which was the ability to seamlessly and effortlessly combine primal movement patterns through space to accomplish a known or novel task. And that one, it's funny, like I had a guy recently who was like, oh, that doesn't make any sense. I'm like, 100% it does. Like there is no test for athleticism. You actually know whether or not somebody is athletic just by watching them move through space. You know, it's like I've used the analogy, I'm not a Ferrari fan, but I appreciate hearing a Ferrari when it pulls up, a front engine V12 Ferrari painted the swoop, the line. I mean, everything, when you pull it up, you know exactly what it is and why it's different. I think the same is true with athleticism and movement, especially, you know, when you start talking about loading good athletes and like, you know, forcing them to enter into this athletic problem solving space. And then once they do it, then you're like, great, go out and do your sport. And let me see how great you can be. And I think that's the greatest indicator for whether or not your training was successful or not, is if you're able to, one, stay injury-free, but if you're able to excel and make it look easy.
Yeah, this is one of their things is like, they don't want you to think about the adaptations they're trying to give you while you play, right? Just go play. Just go be 100% all in. And they liken it to, come into the lab and we're going to give you the keys to a car, a sports car, right? You're going to give your body tools and like, guess what? Like if there are keys dangling in the ignition of a fancy sports car in a driveway, someone's going to turn the keys, right? Like this is how it works with your body. If you have this marvelous set of hips that you've just made more stable or mobile or whatever you're working on, like your body's going to deploy those in landing and jumping and cutting, and you're going to notice the difference and feel better.
Yeah. So how did like, I mean, obviously like you wrote the book, but like, what was the polarizing moment that like led to this book where you said, you know what, like, and I have a book I've been writing, but I need to like just pull myself away for probably about 6 months to finish it. It's all like kind of like doing in pieces. But like, you know, that polarizing moment you had where you decided, you know what, I need to write this ballistic book. This is my contribution.
A few things happened. It was the pandemic, and there wasn't basketball, and I was writing about dirty money in sports, and it was like such a bummer. Like, there were a bunch of like private equity guys who had ties to Jeffrey Epstein who were like kind of on the fringes of the NBA. And I was like, what's going on with that? This is a fun little project. And it just was, John, it was not a fun project at all. Every night I was like, oh my God, the world is such a worse place than I thought it was.
It's it's gross, isn't it?
Oh my God. It's just filthy. It's filthy. Filthy. So, and I was literally getting like death threats and stuff. And so I was like, ah, you know, this is great. But I just decided, I was like, my life is short. I want to do something that's a little more like uplifting and, you know, just more positive. And I wanted to write about someone who's doing something great. And I immediately thought of Marcus, who I'd crossed paths with a little, who was literally, you know, I only knew the bare bones of what they were doing, but I was under the impression that he was basically just making human bodies more robust, mm-hmm. right? Making people more athletic, more bouncy, more fun, more joy, right? And I thought, that seems pretty cool. That seems like something we kind of need. It seemed like everyone around me had some kind of bad knee or hip or ankle or shoulder, and it was kind of, I'm 50, seemed like my cohort, we were kind of like retreating from movement, right? And I was like, no, you want to like, I want to stay in the fight here. I want to like do stuff, right? And so called him up and asked him if he would participate, and he agreed. And then it, from the second I started working on it, like I never got bored. It was never a day that I was like, oh, I just have to finish this book. It's this arduous task. It was always me calling up and being like, wait, tell me about like what? Tell me about this cool thing with the hips and how's that work? And I just kept learning cool stuff. They've been learning cool stuff there for so long. Their process is pretty interesting where it's, you know, I think they have a lot of the conventional wisdom of really elite training and elite athleticism. But then they have this data science part where they've been doing, they have 134.4 terabytes of data of elite athletes moving. It's about a million data points per assessment. So this is from the force plates in the floor and the infrared cameras in the ceiling. And they just have the ability now, the data set's so big that they can start asking questions like, okay, well, what does an ACL tear look like a year before or 2 years before? And the answers that come back are nothing anybody's ever known before, right? Or you know, what is a really interesting question is, what does athleticism look like? Like, how do you move if you succeed in your sport? And this is where one of the big findings is you have a killer set of breaks. It's across sports, it makes a huge difference. And no one really, well, I don't know one, but very few people focus on that before.
Yeah.
There are all these kind of, this whole world is opening up of like, we track how people move and we're finding they move in ways that are often surprising.
Wow. Now it's, I've always, it, so let me see how I make this kind of distinction. So I did a lot of work. I still work with Naval Special Warfare. We write programming and do a bunch of training for the guys at Development Group. Through that, I got reached out to and worked with the 18th Airborne Corps, which was like 90,000 troops. And we went in and taught a ton of seminars.
90,000?
Yeah. So we went in. They were trying to bring Power Athlete and our program in to work with the 18th Airborne Corps. So we were like 2 years in contracting in this piece. And part of, you know, I had to go give a whole bunch of talks, and one of the talks that always come up, and this was really big in the conventional side of the Army, has to do with physical fitness and PT tests, because they tied their advancement and their pay structure to how they performed on PT tests. So when the U.S. military first instituted a PT test, like some form of physical assessment, I think was like, I think it was post-World War One. And when they first did it, it was pretty easy because they were taking kids off the farm who could chop wood and, you know, and do all these different tasks, and they were pretty fit. Then when World War II came up, I think like 70% of the kids that they drafted weren't physically fit enough to go fight the war that they needed, because after World War I, when the kids came home, they didn't go back to the farm. They stayed in the cities, and they saw this massive decline in just physical, you know, capability. So they put this PT test in to try to like stimulate people. And it was actually pretty good. They had to like do pull-ups and push-ups and run, you know, jump over logs, and they had an agility course. Over the course of time, to make it easier, they just went to push-ups, sit-ups, and jogging. Mm-hmm. And it was like a, you know, I think it was a 1.5 mile run. So then everybody just started doing push-ups, sit-ups, and a 1.5 mile run for their training, because if I know what the test is, I'm just going to train for the test. Everybody got dramatically worse. Injuries went through the roof. I mean, the reason we came in was there were so many guys that were on injury profile that were non-deployable. I think it was like roughly over, it was like 16% of the force was non-deployable due to injury. And it was all overuse. It was like back injury, sciatica, calf, lower leg. I mean, it was just all this stuff. So when we went in, we took like a huge cross section, and it was like, I think we had 18 seminars, 50 guys, brought them in, put them on just to have them stop doing what they were doing and just do basic strength training. And all of a sudden their PT scores went up. They got off report, they got off profile, and everything happened. But what was fascinating, for us was that, and one of the big initiatives I pushed at the time was like training for war is training for sport. That like in our lives, because of the, you know, function of computer and the way that we live our lives, like physicality and being physical readiness to be able to, you know, go out and hammer something, or, you know, like what we did and what we've lived for the majority of our existence just doesn't exist. And the way that we're able to develop these skills today that we probably developed, you know, you think about like, you know, hunting or any of the things that we did to survive, planting, I mean, however you want to think, sport is our greatest chance for this. And because the sports that we're playing today, and I see with my own kids, my son's pretty good at baseball. Now they want him to play on these traveling teams, and they want him to play baseball year round. And I'm like, no, He's going to play baseball during baseball season, but he's going to do other sports and he's going to go outside and play. My daughter's same with basketball. My other daughter plays soccer. They like track these kids in and these coaches are like, well, if you don't do this, they're not going to have a chance to play. And I'm like, well, you're creating one-dimensional athletes that are just doing one thing.
Drives me crazy.
Yeah. It's awful. And I think what happens now in the training space, and this is what I'd always like to talk to these guys at P3, and unfortunately they don't have data of guys like 20 or 30 or 40 years ago, but like, you know, the fact that I think that kids today are not as well-rounded or as athletic as they used to be just for the fact that they're not as exposed to as much.
Absolutely. I totally agree. Yeah, I was just thumbing through the book here, but on the page one, before the pandemic, 71% of young Americans, quote, would not be able to join the military if they wanted to because they're not fit enough, according to a government report.
Yeah.
Like, that's not good. You know what I mean? Like, it's not good at all.
The War College, which is in Pennsylvania up, where is it at? It's in Central PA. I spoke at a conference on national security a couple of years ago, and what I spoke on was the lack of physical readiness of 16 to 18-year-olds. In high school right now that are potentially into the force. And it's a massive pandemic for just the lack of physical readiness. There was another guy in my group who gave a talk on the U.S. dependence on foreign-made pharmaceuticals that come from China and India, that if those boats stopped, we have about, he said, anywhere from like 3 to 6 weeks supply. And that without those boats coming, we hemorrhage anywhere from 50 to 70% of our population inside of like 3 to 6 months to a year. He called it the Thanos effect. And I was like, holy shit, that's crazy too.
That's like the opium wars, but like a little twist on it.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Wow. That's crazy. Yeah. And the WHO says that 5 million people a year die from immobility, right? It contributes to every disease practically. So to me, I think we're in the name of safety, right? Where I'm doing air quotes, if you're just listening to this, safety, you know, you're keeping your kids at home, right? You're keeping them supervised, you're keeping them in the basement or whatever they're doing. And it's not safe at all, right? It's literally the fourth leading global cause of death is that they're home, right? And so I don't have a ready solution for how kids can just go roughhouse all the time and play, but their bodies need that, right? It was so clear when my kids got to a certain age, they just started like shoving me, they just started like, they want me to pin them down on the couch and they want to like put their hand on the side of my face and like, you know, pull it or whatever. Like, you know, this is how every young animal on the planet moves, right? Yeah. Is they all just roughhouse all the time and develop this big vocabulary. And then they stand there and say, hey, you think you can jump off this thing? I can probably jump off the thing. You can climb up that thing. And you know, I think that's just how we've always grown up. And I think we probably need that.
I think it's going to come back. I mean, it's funny. I've been reading all this kind of fear mongering stuff. I was on a call yesterday that this designer was showing me AI images that he had created that were like for some product stuff, but it was pretty fascinating. I'm like, so you don't even have to be creative anymore. You just have to have good prompts. And I was like, man, like, what does this teach us that like I can just word things into existence now? Like that there's, you know, like we were talking about earlier, like the ability to be able to do things. I wonder if that just becomes a premium. But was there any like, polarizing injury or anything? I mean, you said that you had had some issues, but was there like one moment where you like, you know, fuck your knee up, had an ACL that you were like, man, I got to pull the ripcord or I got to figure out who to talk to on this?
There, I've had some issues. I was born with hip dysplasia and once a decade or so in adulthood, I have like some kind of back spasm or just like back crisis, and I was thinking I was done with it, and then I wouldn't be done. Then I committed to writing the book. I started writing the book, and then that reared its head in the worst way ever. Where I was, my brother-in-law swung by for Christmas, and he saw how I was sleeping. Where I like, there's the dog bed on the floor, and then I had like a different temporary bed on the floor, open bowl of Tylenol. I had like the Theragun, the heating pad, the ice pack. You know, just like I was in pain like crazy. And but in my head, I had like gotten it together. This was a pretty good system. I was like, you know, sorting out how to muddle through this tough spot, you know. And he saw this. He's like, man, this is just so sad. and I was like suddenly kind of saw it from his point of view. And I'm like, yeah, I'm writing a book about the movement, the joy of movement. And I'm like this, you know, I'm like I'm on the floor. So I had told Marcus and the guys at B3 that I didn't really want to become a client because it would like upset my objectivity or whatever. And Marcus was like, you know, I know you got your issues, your ethical issues, but can you just get over it? And can we just assess you and help you out? And I was desperate enough at that point that I just said, okay. And I flew out there and they assessed me. And there are all these things that are so elementary that you'd think everybody would. I've been to so many doctors and physical therapists and really good people. But from the first second, they're like, oh, you land with 30% more force on your left side than your right. I'm like, oh, that seems important. You know, you can actually see it on the MRI. Like, yeah, that's what's happening. And on and on. And they gave me some, I did one workout. I got assessed on Friday morning. I did one workout on Friday with them, which was hard. I was sweating from like the neurological effort of coordinating these movements. They were like weird movements I hadn't done before. And then Saturday, Marcus invited me to go on a hike. And so we hike and then we get to this kind of dry riverbed. And he's like, you know, a lot of times I like to kind of just hop rock to rock. It's kind of fun. This is not the kind of movement I'd been doing, you know, and flying through the air and land on a rock. And I was not sure how I would land. I was not sure how painful that would be. And it was okay. You know, and then like I do it again and again. And I'm like, oh, like I'm starting to feel like I can move again. Right. And a few months after that, I competed in a high rocks like by myself, which is a, you know, I was just feeling Teflon, you know, I felt freaking great. So I kind of went from, you know, literally worrying if I would be able to play with my grandkids, you know, to who aren't born yet, you know, to, you know, competing against Lance Armstrong in the high rocks. It's pretty fun.
Nice. Well, did Lance compete in high rocks?
He did. He did his first high rocks the same day I did in New York last spring.
Oh, that's awesome. I'm a Lance Armstrong fan. I know he's taken a lot of heat and, you know, a lot of people don't like him. I have no problem with any of the stuff that he did to compete against people that were doing the exact same thing. So, I mean, it, you know, like if anything, like the, you know, but people shit on him, but I think the dude's a savage. I mean, he fucking got on the bike and killed it. And I loved watching him do it.
I have my quibble. I didn't like how he trashed the people who told the truth. Right. Yeah. Like I thought that was uncool. But I did like my favorite part of Lance Armstrong's career was when he was no longer the best and he still went and did the tour. Yeah. And he weighed a little extra and he had kids. And I was like, man, this is the most useful thing for us kids is to see like he's still fighting, even though he wasn't even the best guy on his team. I thought that was I was like, this is when, you know, he has that real dog in him. It's like
the only one that I heard, and I was never able to confirm this, was they were trying to say that he had some motor in his bike. Did you hear this?
Yeah, there was something though.
Yeah. There was some motor like and that I was like, I'm okay with performance enhancing stuff, because when they went back to try to give like the tour championship to somebody, there was like the 40th dude hadn't tested positive and there had been like 12 dudes that had died. I'm like, come on, dude. Like I don't think that anybody went into this thinking these guys were clean. And you know, they all had the same access to everything. So I just kind of figured it was like, so I just was amazed that people were so outraged. And I was like, oh man, like you guys didn't realize these guys had the most developed, doping protocols on the planet. Like it seemed crazy to me.
Did you read this book, The Secret Race?
No, I didn't.
It's honestly, it's super good. It's super good. I really recommend it. It's like, really good writer. We got like kind of all access with Tyler Hamilton, who was one of Lance's teammates.
Oh, yeah.
And, so much good stuff in there. But one of the things that really struck me was like, you know, I'm not going to be a Pollyanna and tell you that I think no one is ever going to use performance drugs, but I think there should be some line that is policed, because otherwise you're encouraging like, you know, the 17-year-old Lance Armstrong to go to some like really shady doctor. And, you know, Tyler Hamilton had like, actually, this is another kind of devious thing Lance did, is Lance went to the only good doctor, Michele Ferrari. And he paid him a whole bunch extra to only work with Lance and people Lance approved. And so when Tyler beat Lance, Tyler was Lance's teammate and beat him up one of the big climbs. And then Lance was like, well, you can't use Michele anymore. And so then Tyler had to go to the shoddy doctor in Spain. And the shoddy doctor sent him the wrong bag of blood in the middle of the tour. And so Tyler was like peeing blood, turned gray. Like, you know, like just like these aren't good doctors, right? And so to me, I'm like if you have Tyler Hamilton's athletic accomplishments and profile, whatever, we should bring your healthcare into the light, sure. Right? Like you shouldn't be dealing with this guy. You mean he literally met him like on the side of the freeway to like swap drugs, blood bags, whatever.
I'm
like,
yeah, that sounds pretty bad to me. Like
just that's not a good use of that guy's body. You know, he's worked too hard.
Well, and then also Lance's, biggest sponsor was U.S. Postal. So now he's like getting the U.S. government involved. But I'm like, the U.S. government is by far the biggest drug pusher on the planet. Like anybody's not surprised by that one. You know, I mean, I don't know. It's, I think.
But can I ask you, what do you know about performance enhancing drugs in the military? Like, is it widespread?
You know what? Let me put it like this. When we went and worked with the 18th Airborne Corps, if somebody told me that they were on performance enhancers, I would have been shocked because, you know, you expect to see a certain, like physical stamp of, you know, like, oh, this guy looks like he's on something. These guys look like they were living on like, you know, monsters and nicotine patches. you know, and then when we go and work with like, you know, obviously Naval Special Warfare and those guys, like most of those guys, especially the guys at DevGru, are sub 200 pounds. You know, some of them are 155 pounds. So, I mean, they're all like sub 200. They're in good shape, like you'd expect from like kind of climbers or guys. But like, if those guys were on performance enhancers, not to say they're not in good shape. Like I wouldn't say, and we've always been very forthright, like, hey, if you guys are going to make this decision, I know you guys have testing, you know, like there are some medical people that you should probably go check out and get your blood work done. And if they want to do some hormone optimization, that's at a doctor's deal. Like I've always recommended for people, do not see a guy on the side of the road. Go get your blood work done. I mean, we've been very fortunate. One of my best friends is Dr. Kirk Parsley, and Doc was a SEAL, and then he was the medical doc for the SEAL teams for like 18 years. Knows more about hormones and sleep than anybody else on the planet. And I'm like, well, you have a resource like Doc Parsley, reach out to him, because there might be some levers that you can pull before you start getting on exogenous drugs. I think what happens a lot of times is guys go to that stuff too quickly. Oh, I'm not feeling good, I'm going to do this, when there's probably a lot of other levers. So I always think if as long as you're dealing with an intelligent, smart doctor that knows what he's doing and kind of has like a little bit of, I guess you could say a little bit of gas, a little bit of brake, not super cavalier, but if you're meeting some random doc on the side of the road to get some bag of blood you don't know, like that's a fucking bad deal.
It's a bad deal, yeah.
Yeah.
So P3, they have this kind of conviction that like, and they used to have t-shirts that were like STBD, I think was their, it's a smart training beats drugs. Mm. So their idea was there was just so much slack in the system of like how to really train that there was no call for drugs, right? They're like, we can get you better in better shape just from like training smarter.
Yeah.
And then they had other shirts that said like something like, no, I'm not on steroids, but thanks for asking, or something like that.
you know, we've seen this in the jiu-jitsu world. That because the strength conditioning is so bad and the access to information and what these guys are able to do, that a lot of them were just taking drugs for the fact that they just didn't know what strength conditioning was. So when I started working with Victor and the guys, that was a big thing. It's like, you know, they came in the first day and, you know, they're some of the top players in the world and they come in and we're lifting weights. And I remember looking at their coach and I'm like, these guys are professionals. Like they've never done any of this stuff. You said they lifted weights. Like they've never done any of this training. So I think there's a lot of land to cover. There's a lot of ground to make up with because there's just so much bad training in the world.
Yeah. So one of the things that I thought, so one of the early things Marcus noticed from having force plates was that like there's a short list of people can throw the baseball 95 miles an hour, right? And they were 100% either giant strong men like Randy Johnson or whatever, or they were tiny men who had unbelievable kinematics, right? Like they had super efficient way of pushing a foot into the ground, which pushed their hip, which pushed their shoulder, which pushed their elbow, which pushed the ball, right? And that second thing, that kinematic movement, is largely what they find their training, right? They want to get your brain to move your existing muscles more efficiently, right? A lot of times there is more muscle to build, but a lot of times it's just, you know, How do we get the muscles you already have to actually deploy in the athletic movement that you want to do?
How many NBA players train at 3P or at P3?
They've assessed 70% of the current rosters. I honestly don't know the number that like currently train there. It's a little bit ad hoc because in season none of them do.
Sure.
Right, and then in the off season, I guess. Well, so right now as we speak, all of the William Morris Endeavor NBA draft guys, which is, I don't know, probably a dozen or so, are there. They have like an exclusive deal to do their pre-draft training for 7 weeks, which is actually kind of a fun time to be there because these are fresh, healthy 17, 18, 19, 20-year-olds who are just bouncy and flying around, and they get to really, like, with 7 weeks, you can really address whatever your big concern is, right? Like, sure. If you you have some concern about your back and the impact when you land, or your lateral explosion so you can keep up with the guys you have to defend on the perimeter in the NBA, et cetera. Like, they get to really address the holes in their system and, like, come away, like, really good. Then they have a pro day at UC Santa Barbara where, like, the whole NBA comes and just sees the, you know, like a Chet Holmgren or Ben Mathurin, or right now they have Dylan Harper, who's, I think, is going to be the second pick in the draft, is there. So this is kind of a peak time right now. And there's a lot of, too, like, so those guys, do you remember Jahlil Okafor was the number one overall draft pick of the Sixers, I don't know, 15 years ago, 12 years ago. And then he had a lot of bad things happen in his life. He ended up playing in Mexico City, and he tore his Achilles in Mexico City. And then sure enough, when I was writing the book, I was out there, and I was waiting for my turn to go in the cryo chamber, and the next guy in line, Jahlil Okafor, you know? And I'm like, what are you doing here? And he's like, well, I came here pre-draft all these years ago. And then I always remembered, like, how serious they were and how everything they'd said made sense. And it was like a scientific approach to my body. And so when he tore his Achilles in Mexico City, he just reached into his own pocket and just flew there and had them rehab his Achilles there.
That's smart. Yeah. Do a lot of other professional athletes, or is it just mainly basketball?
No, there's a lot of other ones. Yeah, all kinds of professional soccer, MLB guys. There's a whole crew of MLB guys. Cedric Mullins he's like a Baltimore, I think he was the first player to have 40 steals and 40 home runs in a season in decades for the for the Orioles. And I happened to watch me there. They was working out. And that dude is, like, awesomely strong. It's so fun. He's, like, super mobile, but just, like, I'm not usually kind of, like, jaw drop, like, look at this fucking athlete. But that guy was, like, awesome. Yeah, there's a whole crew.
It's kind of like
players going there and grew in mass, you know?
It's kind of like a pretty girl walks in. Like, she might not be your type. You're like, oh, I like, you know, tall brunettes or this. But, like, pretty girl walks in, it doesn't matter if she's your type or not, like, everybody knows, like, everybody gets, like, real quiet. It's funny, I've seen, like, NBA guys, like, all of a sudden the girl, like, interviewing him super hot, and they, like, get all super nervous. But, like, the same thing happens, like when you train with a bunch of athletes and you watch somebody do something that's outside what you regularly see. It's impressive, and, like, that's that little thing, like, that's that undescribable spark. You're like, I don't know, like, you know, because you said he was super strong, he was mobile, he just did things, it was different, like, it was inspiring. Like, those are the exact statements that when you see the world's best athletes do something, they make it, and it's that effortless. Like, they just make it look seamless and effortless. They're able to do things at a rate, at a speed, at a, you know, a velocity that, like, it never looks out of control. It always looks kind of easy, like they're just pushing just to it and they got it. And that was something I used to observe all the time in the NFL, where you'd see guys like there were guys that were working way too hard to get done what they were, and there was other guys that weren't working hard enough, but they were just making it look easy every single day. And that was that, like, weird kind of, like, why certain guys were so much better than others.
Yeah. Yeah. Marcus and I spent a couple of years really talking deeply about just movement, and which means we ended up talking about animals a lot, because animals are just unbelievable movers. And one of the things, to your point about, like, the pretty girl walking in, one of the things that really struck me was, okay, and you can see this on YouTube, there's a bunch of examples of, like, the alpha mountain goat, you know, comes down, and all the little young male ones really want to take his spot, which means they want to fight. But they can't, like, what it really struck me was, goats, no wild animal can afford to lose a bunch of fights. They don't have doctors. They don't have antibiotics, right? They can't just go bleeding all the time. Mostly you need to scare people away from wanting to fight with you, right? That's 95% of the job. Is you just need to be such a goddamn boss. You need to be Cedric Mullins, right? You need to have everyone in the room be like, oh, like, why don't we leave that guy alone? Like, that's really the way that you are the alpha in nature, right? You just can't fight every little upstart one. And so you can see it. Like, this is, like, biomechanically sound movement is pretty similar to just these completely regal, like, absolutely boss wild animals that nobody messes with, right? Like, I watched a peregrine falcon came into my backyard while I was writing the book, landed on the ground. Every bird is absolutely losing their mind, right? They're just like, oh my God, like, the worst thing ever has happened. And the peregrine falcon is just super calm and still. I thought about Omar in The Wire, who's like the most feared guy. And, like, he arrives in the middle of the day and walks down the middle of the street, and everyone's like, oh, coming, right? Like, and The Peregrine Falcon is Omar.
Dude, just you just got a big plus. I'm a huge Wire fan.
Okay.
And what's hilarious was, so I watched The Wire on like a portable DVD player. You know, cool. This is how long ago I watched The Wire. And small story, the guy that actually gave me The Wire, like all the seasons, like brought them to me in like a bag and was like, here you go, I want you to watch these. Jason Whitlock. Who was one of the one of the sports writers in Philly. And Jason's a fucking asshole. He used to write just fucking terrible things and rip us to shreds. But for some fucking reason, whenever he would come over, we had like a little bit of coolness. And then I remember like one time we were talking and he's like, man, I got something for you. And he came in and he brought me like all the DVDs, the full season of The Wire. And I think at the time I didn't have a TV or a DVD player. I think I had a computer. So I went down, I'd bought like one of those like screens that pop up and I used to watch it. And dude, I sat down and I'm not kidding you, I binge watched that thing over the course of a couple weeks. And it's always been, and to this point, like, I mean, it's probably the best TV and the most realistic shows ever done. So I appreciate you throwing that in there.
So good. I love The Wire so much. Or the other one, we say this all the time when I work at the ESPN, like the deputy likes dots. Put a little dot next to it because the deputy likes dots. That was an eye opener to me that you want to move like a wild animal, right? You want to stride out. You want to be, you know, chest up, moving big. And I, in the course of writing the book, I ran into bears twice. The first time, I was mountain biking and these people were yelling off in the distance. And I was like, what are they talking about? And I stopped. I'm like, what? And then male and female, they just keep yelling. And then he stops yelling. And then her words ring out. She goes, young male is all I can hear. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. And then kind of in between us from the rise, this very big black bear just appears coming like directly at me. I know you're supposed to get big. And you're supposed to be still. And you're supposed to do exactly what I'm talking about with like being alpha and owning the space, but I just ran away. I got on my bike and I pedaled away and like, it was way too slow. If that guy wanted to kill me, he would have absolutely had me. And I was like aware, I was like contorting my body to be small. Like I was like compressing myself. I was making myself prey. I was making myself like a snack, you know?
Did you ever think about why that was the case? Like why animals move so well?
Because they have to.
Well, because if they were, the bad ones get killed.
Yeah.
And the weak ones like get pushed out of the nest or, you know, like if a mama cub has three cubs and one of them's weak, she ends up just leaving the weak one to die because they don't have the energy that it would take her to like, you know, manage the weak one. Like, I mean, you know, we see this kind of like the strongest will survive in everything. I mean, you see it at like the apex predators all the way down. I mean, to the amount of, you know, like I, like the amount of things that I've seen out here living in Texas where like, you'll see like a, you know, like a mama deer and like the fawns and the fawn will fall and break its leg. Mm-hmm. And like, there's really nothing like the mom can do. It just leaves it. And then something comes and eats it and we'll find it and be like, oh, well, and then my wife's always like, oh, it's so sad. The mama deer left. It's like, well, she's not going to be able to give up her life and her other fawns. And if one falls and breaks its leg, it's like, this is nature. I think humans are the only ones. And there's that, great, it was in G.I. Jane, which is an absolute terrible movie and not representative of naval special warfare. But the guy, I think it was Viggo Mortensen, gets up and he gives that speech about, you know, I think it was Robert Frost, about like, you'll never see a wildling feel sorry for itself. You'll see it freeze and be able to, I'm going to butcher the poem. But I always think in nature, I mean, you have such natural selection over time that the reason that these things are able to move so well is the fact that all the shitty ones got eaten. Mm-hmm. And you know, they don't really get a chance to pass on their bloodline, which in with humans, like obviously, you know, intelligence plays a massive factor in survivability. And if you just created natural selection for the world's best athletes, probably be in a slightly different position. We probably wouldn't be going to Mars and having AI, but we'd probably all be pretty good movers.
You can't rely on blind faith to get the pregnancy support you deserve. Ritual's Essential Prenatal Multivitamin is the only leading prenatal backed by its own human clinical trial. Essential Prenatal is proven to deliver key nutrients, including folate, biotin, and vitamin D during pregnancy. Get 25% off when you visit ritual.com/clinical. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views, and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, everyone moved well in the Paleolithic, right? Like, it's just a modernity that makes us a little bit clunky. But we're clearly wrong, right? I mean, it just seems to me that I always think about there's a scene in WALL-E where, like, the people just are locked in. Everyone's overweight and everyone's in, like, a recliner in space.
Yeah.
You know, like, now that I know how much of our brain is dedicated to movement, like, there's no way you're putting this brain on a server and having it work right, no. Right? There's no way you're having it sit in the lounger all day. Like, no, our movement is super core to us, right? Nothing works if you don't move. And so we're going to have to figure it out. We're going to have to be moving. That's what we're going to have to do. We have to be a little bit more like wild animals.
Yeah. Years ago, and I'm going to butcher this as well, but years ago, we were trying to do a podcast with a guy who was a researcher out of Australia, and there was a lake bed that they had found. And I think the guy either wrote the book or did some a little research on it, but they found this lake bed that actually had human footprints. And when they went and they looked at the human footprints, they realized that it was actually like 6 or 8 humans that were running and chasing an animal. And based upon the size of the foot, they had, you know, like they were anywhere from like a 9 to a 10.5, but like they looked and they were able to see the size of the foot. They knew the depth and then they knew the spacing. And so they were able to kind of like understand the size and the weight, but more importantly, the speed at which they were running. And they were running at like 28, 29 miles an hour, chasing an animal like on the outside. And they did this over the course of the lake bed. So they were like, so wait a minute, there were random dudes in Australia that were not just a few of them, but like 6 or 7 or 8 of them that were running just slower than Usain Bolt, not in 100 yards, but over the course of much longer. And we just happened to have the snapshot of these humans. Like, this is just a good indicator that this was more the norm than the exception. And, you know, the idea was that we've de-evolved so far. But I mean, if you think about, you know, like the Spartan babies, you know, throwing the weak ones off, it just, I mean, it makes sense that like a de-evolution.
That, there's a story from, I think, New Mexico, similar like lake bed footsteps where the human footsteps are running after a giant sloth. And at that point, a giant sloth is like, I think it's the size of like 2 rhinoceroses. It's like this huge thing with like giant long arms and big claws and teeth and could easily kill a human. But they're running. And then the sloth has an area that the researchers call the flailing circle, where like inside the flailing circle, it can flail at you, right? And they run into the flailing circle and win, right? Like, do you know how badass you have to be to have Stone Age tools and run into the flailing circle of a giant sloth? But these are the people that we come from, right? These are the people who won, right? Who won evolution. And, you know, we have some of that in us. And I think it's a little bit, well, you know, they had this thing called the Harvard Fatigue Laboratory, where before World War II, they would just subject people to terrible things, right? They were, and honestly, it was disgustingly, speaking of like dirty money, it was funded by the Rockefellers because they owned like mines and different businesses in tropical climates. They wanted to know like how hard they could push the workforce and like what temperatures and like how many hours a day and stuff. So they
did the Rockefellers they, like, start like a town in Brazil around rubber or something. Didn't they build like some crazy town in Brazil?
I wouldn't be the perfect person to ask, but I'm open to anything.
Right? Okay. Sorry.
But Harvard Fatigue Lab basically found, this was early physiology, right? But they found, and in World War II, the military started funding it, and they switched it to like, you know, what can soldiers handle in North Africa?
It was Henry Ford established Fort Landia in Brazil for automobile rubber. Okay, so it wasn't the Rockefellers, but the similar kind of nefarious, like, secret
organizations. Sorry, everybody who lived in Fort Landia. That sucks. But basically they found there were not physical limits for almost anything that we could cope with, right? Humans can deal with almost anything, right? It's very hard to find a hard limit of like below this temperature, you're going to die, above this temperature, you're going to die. You know, there's one experiment that one of the guys did, Stephen Horvath, who later became one of Marcus Elliott's mentors, where they just had like grade school kids walk laps of the track in 108 degrees and outside Vegas. Like they'd do stuff like this. Like, and in fact, it's like almost everyone can take it. And so, this is why Marcus came up with this Misogi idea, where once a year you're going to do some just extraordinarily difficult thing. One of their first ones was to paddleboard from the Channel Islands to Santa Barbara, which is almost 30 miles. And Kyle Korver, NBA player, had never paddleboarded in his life. And it was 9 hours, which is paddleboarding. And the idea is that you're going to quiet the little panicky part of your voice that says, oh my gosh, this is dangerous, it's stupid, we're not going to do this, like it's too much. And you're just going to, like, every cell in your body is saying stop, but you're like, no, I think I'm just going to keep going. And once you finish it, I haven't done this, but people report this kind of self-regard where you're kind of like, no, I think I can probably solve like all kinds of problems I didn't know I could solve. Mm.
Yeah, we had Colin O'Brady on the podcast who walked across Antarctica. That was a gnarly story. And the only thing and the only question I was really fascinated on was I didn't research it on purpose, but I had like written down what I thought was his food source. So he drug like a sled with his food. Mm-hmm. And then over the course, you know, obviously he ate his food, it got lighter and lighter. But I was like, I got an idea on the food and I was pretty close. It was like a mix of like almost like a pemmican that was mixed with coconut oil and this. And he had kind of like made these bars and he had like it all laid out. So he knew how many days, how many bars. And it was kind of how he did it. But he didn't. It was so because there's no physical landmarks in Antarctica. So he had like some form of device where he set the coordinate, and when he was walking, every step he took in the right direction, it would beep. And if he went off course, it didn't beep, and he'd have to figure it out. So he just like walked to these beeps. Like the story was by far one of like the greatest triumphs of humanity. You're out there in the middle of Antarctica, like nobody's coming to save you. The closest people are days away, and you're just out there walking. And
how long? How long did it take him?
Let me look it up. How long did...
A long time, right?
I mean, no, he did months. It. He did it pretty quick. I mean, it wasn't as bad across Antarctica. It took him 54 days.
54 days. I read this book by Randall Fiennes, who's like, I think the crazy explorer uncle of like the actors, Joseph Fiennes. And Randall Fiennes crossed Antarctica with a sled, but he describes this like... You know, the problem is you're hauling the sled out of holes all the time, right? Like, because it's just not flat, right? It's like these it just seemed like kind of a nightmare.
Well, that and you got to dodge the pyramids and then the big wall, the ice wall at the end of the world, you know?
the boundary?
Yeah, so that was another question I asked him. I was like, first of all, did you see anything? And he's like, no, it was just all white. And but he said, you know, he's done a bunch of speaking engagements and he'll always get like one or two people that are kind of like milling around at the end. And you'll see him go talk to him, be like, so can I answer any questions? They're like, you saw it, didn't you? And he's like, saw what? He's like, the wall or this? And he's always like, no. And he's like, they got to you. And then they all leave like totally upset. And he's like, I didn't see anything. My two buddies, Mike Sorelli and Andy Stumpf, they did this thing called 777, where they skydived into seven continents in 7 days. And they skydived into Antarctica. So they like, you know, jumped out of a plane as they're coming through the clouds. I asked him, I was like, dude, did you have like a clear view of Antarctica? Could you see the whole thing? He's like, oh yeah, we could see everything. You know, like we saw like the whole thing. I mean, both all the oceans and all this. And I was like, did you see any pyramids or any like space stations or, you know, Bill Gates' secret laboratory for the supervillains? He's like, we didn't see anything. It must all be underground. So I always laugh at that one.
They did a really good job with the big budget. You know, they made it really nice. Yeah. I have a little bit of like a flat earther counter argument that I haven't rolled out before, but I want to try it now, which is take the world airline schedule, right? Like any airline, there's a flight from Los Angeles to Kuala Lumpur, or you can go around the world. Which one's not happening? Which flight is false, right? If there's an edge, you know what I mean? There's mm-hmm. a bunch of flights that just aren't happening. These are lying flights, right? Like mm-hmm. I think you could probably go check out every flight. I think they all happen. They take off and they land. There's the same people who were in Kuala Lumpur end up in Delhi. And then from Delhi, you can go to London. From London, you can go to New York. From New York, you can go to LA. Like, what the fuck? You know what I mean? Like, if you can do all those flights, it's a round planet. That's just...
Yeah. I think that the flat Earth theory, and this is hilarious because we were trying to get the flat Earth people to come on the podcast because we wanted to debate them. Ken Ford, who was the president of the Institute of Human and Machine Cognition, he's like a DARPA-funded research group we did a bunch of work with. His like favorite thing, because when I was in his office, he had this like flat Earth deal, and I was like, "You flat earther?" He's like, "I'm part of the society, but our society is about dispelling flat Earth." And then we got into like all of these things where they've like literally proved that the Earth is round. And then he always goes back to it and he's like, "Who would it benefit?" like if it was round or flat, it doesn't change anything in our day. Like, why would, like, you know, and they're always like, well, that's because, you know, you're keeping the secret. It's I don't know. I feel like there's a lot of fights that I'm probably worth dying for, like whether or not the earth is round or not. Like, that just feels kind of inconsequential to me.
It's pretty stupid. It really is. Okay, I want to share a theory, a personal theory that emerged from writing this book and get your thoughts on it, because okay. I think this is the kind of stuff you think about. So I mentioned that they found brakes are super effective.
Yeah, the ability to reduce force and slow down is a massive indicator of athleticism.
Right. So they learned it with James Harden. You know, they had 20 people in the building. James Harden's getting assessed. It's like people from Adidas, James Harden's friends, people from the team. And at this point, he's the highest scorer in the NBA. They go through the assessment, and this really nice guy, Eric, who's like a big brain Stanford Columbia graduate, is looking at, he's the nicest guy in the world. And he's looking at the computer screen, and he's told them, he's promised he's going to give them like an early preview of James's report, which everyone knows is going to be incredible because he's James Harden, right?
Sure.
And Eric's looking at it, and he's like, it's just like, he's not fast. He doesn't cut well. He's not jumping. He's not going to win a dunk contest. But there's only one little thing where he stands out, which is he can stop on a dime. Mm. And so Eric kind of rolls this out as like, well, you know, here's what we found. He's really, really good at stopping. And they actually did integrate it into his Harden 1 shoe, a little bit of stopping rubber or something. And but meanwhile, they were like, well, they were stressed about it at P3 because they're like, we can't really explain why he's the best player in basketball if it isn't because of this stopping, right? Our systems are missing something if he doesn't have some physical advantage. He probably can't just use his court vision and his ability to fool refs like to be so good every night against every opponent. And so they're like, well, if it's the stopping, then this other kid, there's like an overweight Slovenian who was visiting with his mom. He had elite stopping numbers. And they're like, well, if stopping really matters, then this kid will be good. That turned out to be Luka Doncic. Mm. And so they're like, oh, it really is something. Then my favorite part of the story is Joe Gibbs Racing, the NASCAR mm-hmm. team, started, they contracted with P3 to screen candidates to be on their pit crews. And they modeled the physiological demands of like every position. And they would find, because it's a weird sport because nobody grows up playing it. Mm-hmm. So they're like, well, there's like the jack man is ideally 6'2 and has this kind of movement signature. And so they would find people from other sports who move like that. Or like, and they would get like defensive ends to be tire carriers, and they'd get baseball players to do, I forget what job. Anyway, but the guy who ran Joe Gibbs' team, who still does, interviewed him quite a lot, really smart guy. But he was like, if there were two candidates who were similar, I'd always take the one with better breaks because the team would do better for reasons that he couldn't really understand. I've cooked up this theory where, like, I think that when James Harden has, it's mostly posterior chain, right? He can put his foot on the ground and stop his body faster than the defender can stop his body. Mm-hmm. But that really good stopping system doesn't just come with the ability to stop. It also comes with the ability to hold your eyes still, which is what every predator does.
Yeah.
Like if you watch a cheetah running, like, right, it has to not just catch up to the antelope, but it has to put its teeth into the perfect place to kill the antelope, right? Yeah. Or the whole thing is a waste.
Have you ever seen them take birds of prey?
Yes.
And they'll do this and they move them all around and their heads never move. They always stay level.
I think your break measurement at P3 captures some of that bird, right? What you're describing. And I think that James Harden, when he's doing a step back, sees the rim very clearly compared to some other athletes who don't have such good breaks, right? And I think that this guy on the Joe Gibbs team who has a 3-meter curved race carrying a tire, right? This is what he does. He has to run around the hood of the car, and then he has to place the tire. And if he's all gas, no brakes, he can't place the tire. But if he's pretty good at gas and pretty good at brakes, then he can get the tire exactly where it has to go. And I think this is kind of a little magic, like, all through nature, you see these that like you're describing with the bird. And I think that this is like a skill that we want in our own athleticism, right? Is well, know, your eyes function.
So what I assessed over the course of, like, you know, not only in my NFL career, but training with a lot of high level athletes, I used to train at Athletes Performance. We ended up like Abby Wambach, and like there was a bunch of like other professional athletes.
Derek Rose was there for a while, I know.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, we would show up, and obviously we were football players, and we had a pretty good amount of football players, but there was a ton of other athletes from other places. And what was universally true, and I've seen this not only in training the pro athletes, I mean, same with, we see the guys at, like, you know, Navy Special Warfare. Everybody has that one little thing that makes them unique that I call their wheelhouse. Like, hey, like, if this is your wheelhouse, they know what their wheelhouse is, they're the best at it, and they stay in their wheelhouse. Now, you can develop other aspects and, like, other traits and, you know, kind of stress other things, but never at the point of taking somebody out of their wheelhouse. Like, if they're big, strong, and fast, you need them to be big, strong, and fast. Now, if it's like flexibility, mobility, you know, Hardy is an interesting one in that he moves extremely well, but he doesn't look like an athlete. Like, and I always liked, I think he was wearing a fat bodysuit there for a while where he was trying to get them to cut him, you know? So James Hardy's obviously got a good fucking hilarious sense of humor, but when you watch him on the court, he doesn't move fast, but he's able to kind of like move through space and like move his body in relation to other people. He's just somebody asked me if speed is a component of athleticism, and I disagreed. Because, you know, Shanji Ibarra, who I work with, you know, Shanji's like considered, like, I hate when people say this, though, like the Michael Jordan of jiu-jitsu. His jiu-jitsu is not fast. It's very slow and methodical and so technical. And he, like, it's almost like he's like a snake. Like, he just kind of, like, once he gets you into his position, he just... And everything is this and counterstep. And it's almost frightening because he's not moving fast and he's absolutely smashing you. And so when somebody asked me, they were like, oh, you know, speed is, I'm like, he doesn't move fast. And he's just so technical that he moves as fast as he needs to execute the task. And that's a component. So when I watch James Harden, he never, like, when you watch him dribble and you move and he's kind of like, you know, working through the crowd, it's never looks fast. Like, he never looks like he's moving, but he's always moving in control. And I think like that control factor is him putting his foot in the ground, stepping back and doing things. I think he just does it better than other people can. And that's why he's one of the best at what he does.
Yeah. My friend David Thorpe he trains NBA players in the basketball part of basketball. And he's big, like, should be used to have five speeds, right? And you need to move the speed the defender isn't. Right. And so college players tend to think, well, I should go fifth gear and then we'll see if they can catch up with me, which probably worked in high school. And by the NBA, everybody can go that fast. Right. So it's like, it's a particularly stupid way to go because now they know exactly where you're going to be because you can like time up the guy who's at max speed because he's not going to go faster. Right. But to me, Harden's just like, oh, he's in one, two, or three, like most of the time. Maybe he hits a four once in a while, really blow your mind, but he just needs to not be where you are. Right. And he has a lot of ways to get away from where you are. Right. Which is, might be moving laterally, might be moving backward, might be moving forward, might be moving slower, faster. But like, his brain is all there the whole time in every situation he puts himself in. Whereas so many super athletic dudes get into a spaz, right? They, there's this great, Corey Brewer was a great dude. Like, he, you know, he's explaining this play where he like beat his guy on the perimeter and he's like got a super lively body and he flies into the lane and he gets up in the air and the coach is like, then what happened? He's like, then I ran out of talent.
like a pretty good joke we have is like, you know, like, hey, like what happened on that roll? What happened? You're like, man, I ran out of talent. Like, that is a universal, like, you know, there's a point at which you kind of hit. And, it's, you know, in football, I mean, this happens all too often. And I think one of the things I assessed pretty early on, like, so I was very, unlucky, but also very fortunate. My rookie year, I come in and start as a rookie at right tackle, and I got hurt at the end of the first half. I ended up rupturing my patellar tendon. My left foot got caught in the seam. I got hit. My just fucking tendon blew up. I tore the retina.
AstroTurf seam? You talking about that kind of seam?
Yeah. It was old Veterans Stadium, which was like basically like golf turf on on concrete. And there was a seam, and I put my foot in, and my foot got stuck. And then the defensive lineman hit me, and when he hit me, like something gave, and it was my knee. So they cart me off. They stitched me back up. Like 3 weeks, I couldn't bend my knee. 3 months, I really was like pretty useless. You know, and as I'm a rookie in Philadelphia, I'm from California. Like there was nothing for me to do. So I just started watching film. I would just kind of go in there, do some rehab, and then I would just go in and watch film.
Well, because you didn't have the wire yet.
Dude, I had nothing. Yeah. I didn't have a TV. I was like just a fucking rookie, right? This is like 99, 2000. So I'd go in the facility and I would just watch film over and over again. And I came to the conclusion that the difference between the winner and the loser in football is the guy that can maintain his technique longer than his opponent is the guy that wins. Like that was it, right? So as an offensive lineman, I have a technique. Like, you know, I want to bend my knees. I want to punch, slide, do all the stuff that I do. The defensive lineman's goal is to get me out of position, get me to raise up, push me here, and force me out of good technique. If I can, like, impose my will and keep technique longer and basically match his force and basically, like, overcome it to be able to keep my technique, I win. And I'm like, I never saw one instance where a guy was able to maintain his technique longer that he didn't win. And I remember being like, hold on. Wait a minute. This is simple. Now I just have to find a ways to challenge this technique through space. And like a lot of what I've been teaching with Power Athlete, we've been railing on about for fucking ever, has became from that moment, that like epiphany of like, oh, if I can move through space and basically force my will upon this individual longer than he can do it to me, I'll basically be successful. And then you start thinking about, like, you know, within basketball now, all of a sudden it's not that, but now I got to move my body in response to, let's say, gravity or force or other factors. Like, that guy's here, I need to move here. Now I have to be able to move my body and control movement and then be able to execute a shot and do all these things like through space to accomplish these tasks. And the people that are able to do it and make it look the easiest tend to be the people that do the best because they avoid injury. And, you know, if they're light on their feet and they're really, you know, skilled at what they do with the ball, then they can avoid and they can play a long time. It's the guys that look like that they're working at like a 9 or 10 in everything that they're doing are the guys that end up breaking down and not surviving very long.
They're living in the red zone. Yeah. So P3 took a few years ago, they took all of the data that they have, anonymized athlete data, NBA player data, and had some machine learning thing just kind of grind through it for months and figure out, like, what kinds of athletes are there? What groupings make sense? And it came up with these seven types of NBA athlete. And, you know, it was like force movers, there's specimens, there are hyper-athletic guards. But the special group, the one that they train everyone to be more like, they call kinematic movers. And they're the ones that Mark will tell you, like, you know, that guy can land on right foot, left foot, 2 feet, can jump laterally off any foot in any direction. And he's kind of like, it's a body like a Swiss Army knife that has like a tool for every problem. So that basically you're keeping your technique no matter what the game delivers you, right? So you're never having this kind of crazy big force improvised moment. Instead, you're having a series of lower force moments that you've practiced, right? That you know how to use. And those guys have kind of freakish success in the NBA, where, to your point, they don't get hurt. And, you know, they don't win. They don't win the jumping contest or the sprinting contest, but they're athletic in a way that's super functional because they have the huge vocabulary.
Do you think PEDs and performance enhancers are big in the NBA?
They're not big, but they're certainly present. I've been kind of sniffing around this topic for 20 years. And, you know, every now and again, a player fails a test. So that's a clue that there are some. And mostly I've had conversations with like trainers and players who are really worried about the other guy. Like they're worried, like, do I have to dope because I think this guy might be. But the way that, you know, the particular obstacle of the league is the schedule, right? 82 games a year, sometimes 5 a week. So like it lends itself, and the testing's not good, right? Yeah. You could easily evade. The Lance Armstrong book tells you everything you have to know about how to never fail an NBA drug test. So I would be surprised if there weren't people messing with, like, not so much maybe anabolics, but just recovery, you know,
sure.
HGH, EPO, like this kind of stuff, right? Because they're exhausted all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, I always have always heard LeBron James kind of name mixed up in that a little bit. I don't know if anything, I mean, I would not be surprised for a guy that's had that longevity, but he also got to the NBA when he was 18 and he spends money on training and his body and other stuff. But I think that there's like this weird, interesting... I guess it's like an ethical piece with professional sports, right? Like, okay, and this is something I always used to ask the doctors. I'm like, okay, like I tore my ACL when I was in my third year in college, and then they stitched it back. I came in, NFL, tore my patellar tendon in my left knee, and then somewhere over the course of the next 10 years, my right ACL disintegrated. The reconstruction. So I haven't had an ACL for years. I never noticed. Mm-hmm. And we ended up having a guy on the podcast who's an ACL expert. And he's like, you know, there's a third of the population that are called compensators, which they don't need an ACL. About a third can kind of do some stuff, and then a third can't walk. And it just so happens that, like, you know, you're a compensator and you don't really need it. Now you can put me in some positions and I kind of like feel like the little bit of slide, but like overdeveloped hamstrings and some of the other kind of components I have kind of hide it a little bit. But, you know, in the NFL, like, you know, you break a limb or, you know, like I kind of jacked my thumb up at jits. I did this on my right hand and they just injected the shit out of my thumb and casted it. So like these doctors were like fine to be able to like give pills, do injections, you know, oh, you took a little too many painkillers. Let me give you an Adderall. Let me, you know, Toradol. So they had all this other stuff. But then all of a sudden these guys like come on this other side and like, okay, here's some like, you know, peptides or drugs that are, you know, potentially increase healing. No, no, not these, but these. So I thought it was a weird kind of line in the sand. I mean, obviously there's a legality issue and, you know, the testing is there and you're not going to do it. But I just, I'm like, so you inject this guy with Toradol, but if he were to take let's say growth hormone or BPC or some of these peptides, like that's illegal. Like it just felt very like, just didn't make a lot of sense to me.
I've been to so many like conferences where they basically have this question, right? They're like, you know, what's legal? What should be legal? And I think I know the answer. I think that the answer is the athletes are allowed to use any tool that the audience uses. And if they have tools the audience doesn't understand, it feels like cheating to the audience, and the audience pays the bills, right? So I think this is where, like, you know, there'll probably come a time when testosterone will get acceptable because it's very commonly used. I think it's like the most prescribed drug, right? So once everybody knows somebody's on testosterone, then it's like, all right, now go ahead, you can use it, you know, whoever it would be. So, but I think, you know, and there's always this like, well, caffeine is a performance drug. Why is that allowed? And it's like, well, because everybody fucking gets it. You know, everybody knows ice bags. Everybody knows aspirin, right? But everybody doesn't know peptides. Like, that seems a little weird. That seems a little back alley to most people.
Okay. Well, dude, that is asked and answered because, like, yeah, I mean, if I guess if the crowd or the fans know it and they use it, then it's there. If they don't, if it seems weird, they're like, oh, that seems weird. I don't think I like it. No, it's a great, I think that's a perfect one. I do have a couple questions about the book, right? We're here to talk about your book.
Yeah.
One of the things you talk about in the book is you describe NBA players as race cars that are in constant need of repair. And this kind of goes back like to kind of piggyback off this question. Like, do you think like the average fan or just the most normal person have like no concept of like how athletic and durable and like the pounding that these guys take? I mean, like you talked about, what was it? 5 games a week. What was it? 86 games, 85 games at the end?
82 regular season games a year plus playoffs and preseason.
I mean, that's a ton of games. And, you know, they have practices. I mean, they have summer league. I mean, these guys are playing hoops all year round. Like, is there, because, you know, like all of a sudden, if a guy gets injured and he's out for a couple games, all of a sudden the fans fucking turn on these guys so quick. And I'm like, dude, this guy, it's shocking. Like I've never in my life as a former professional athlete ever looked at as an athlete and like, oh, this guy's a malingerer. He doesn't want to play. Like you're out there to play. People want to be great and you do greatness on the court or on the pitch or on the field, whatever it is. Like I've very few times run into guys that are there just trying to like somehow steal a paycheck for whatever. But that's like a very, very common feeling for the fans to have. And they kind of get down on a guy. And once they get that kind of like that tint put on them, it's hard to get off.
Yeah. It's been a weird thing to be a part of. My career has mostly been digital where there are comments and like fans get to pile on with their opinions on everything I've ever written, basically. And it is strange to me how frequently they don't believe NBA players are working really hard. And, you know, maybe a little racism. Like, it just feels like how, you know, how could you possibly think these people are lazy? Mostly because a billion people play basketball. And if you're not the best of the best, you're not getting minutes, right? Like, there are so many long-limbed, incredible athletes who are dying or just outside the NBA and ready to work crazy hard. It just doesn't make sense that, like, you know, J.R. Smith is just partying too much and he can't compete. It's like, no, he's really a serious professional, right? He's a more serious professional. Actually, like, by my little dumb analysis, you're more likely to be an American citizen who becomes a U.S. senator than a basketball player who makes the NBA, statistically, right? Like, it's really freaking competitive,
yeah.
Right? And, yeah, and the fact that the idea that they're not tough to me, there's a moment when Kevin Durant tore his Achilles in the NBA Finals. And just watch the video. He's just calm as hell. And he's just like, let me see if I have an Achilles. And he's like, ah, bummer. You know, like no part of him is like, ah, I'm like, and he's just like, ah, I really wanted to have an Achilles. You know, don't have it. Like, that's a pretty tough dude, right? Yeah. Like, it's pretty tough by the time you're just like, just super calm. The whole Toronto fans are just ringing down. They're cheering. They're delighted because they're scared of him. And now he's hurt, right? He's off the court. And he's just like, well, let me just check. I found NBA players to be delightful, hardworking, serious professionals. And when I first started covering the league, it was kind of like Allen Iverson time. There was a little more like off-court drama kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But the league got much more explosive and physical.
Practice.
But like it's like my friend David Thorpe, who trains players, like he wants to meet up with them for like a beer once in a while because they do all this work remotely, right? They're on. He's like a private trainer, and he doesn't see them very often, but he loves them, and they get along great. And the meetup is like, hey, you know, let's grab a beer, and they're like, oh, we don't drink in season. Like they won't have like a beer all season because like they're just such finely tuned athletes, right? Mm-hmm. It's gonna interrupt their sleep a little bit, and they know how much, and they want to be good for shoot around tomorrow. So these dudes are super hardworking, and mostly they're like incredibly smart. You really can't, you got to process, you know, like to make all these decisions well. And the idea that they're somehow just lazy or frail or weak, it kind of pisses me off, to be honest. Like they go super hard.
Yeah, there is definitely a misconception about it, but I also think it goes back to the average fan has no concept of like the amount of time that they don't see. They only, you know, they turn on the game, they see this guy and he's in a t-shirt and shorts and he shoots hoops and I got a basketball. You know, I can't believe these guys are just getting paid to play. I don't know if they realize the amount of time that's leading into that or that goes into the preparation. I mean, football was the same thing. Like these fucking bums, especially playing in Philly, and you're like, dude, every time we go out there, we want to win because life is better when we win. Like nobody wants to lose. I just think
when you're the tip of the spear, it's really hard to get there, right? Yeah. Like it's hard to get there. If you were screwing around, if you were like coming into work high on drugs, whatever, like you're not going to be the right tackle for the Philadelphia Eagles. That's just not how the world works. Like they will get somebody else to do that job because lots of people want that job.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. You also drew a parallel between ACL injuries and heart attacks. Both are preventable through early diagnostics. What was some of the stuff that you saw like within the assessments that they were doing at P3 that were, you know, because you brought up ACLs, like, I mean, for a long time, like the ACL was considered this like death nail. You get an ACL tear, like your future is bleak. It's never going to come back. But I mean, I think, you know, a ruptured disc, I think Achilles, I mean, some of the other injuries to me, I mean, we've kind of cracked the code on ACLs. Like they know how to fix them. They know how to get them back. Like it's no longer has the stigma that it used to, but I'm kind of interested to know like in that like prevention model, you know, what they're doing to work with their athletes to make sure that they're not tearing ACLs or just at least assess them early.
Yeah, no, there's great findings here. I mean, it's super useful kind of game changer stuff. So I could show you lectures on YouTube of like the finest ACL experts in the land talking about how every theory has counter evidence, right? So like women have more ACL tears because their hips are wider or sure. because of valgus collapse or because they have narrower tendons or because of the notches smaller or because of hormones. There are studies to suggest all those. There are also studies to prove the exact opposite. Every single theory is frustrated, right? Which to me tells me we're still in the noise, right? This is how we were with heart attacks years ago, where we thought maybe it was God striking you down for thinking evil thoughts, right? And then the electrocardiogram came along, like, oh, it's arterial blood flow slowing, and which means we can see the crisis before the heart attack, right? And we can intervene with diet and exercise before the crisis, right? So with ACL tears, again, 134.4 terabytes of data from all these athletes and in a retrospective study of almost 400 NBA players over years, like how do you move when you end up with an ACL tear? And 100% of the people who ended up with an ACL tear in that study, and again, this is all men, this is NBA players, has the habit of landing on the outside of their foot and have their weight roll to the inside, which moves your shin. The injury risk elevates at 25 degrees of like your shin moving like a windshield wiper. Mm-hmm. You can imagine that would set your knee up in a bad position. The number two leading cause is femoral rotation. So as you're landing, as you're squatting, your femur rotates within your leg. It's like twisting the drumstick off the turkey, right? Can fully sever your ACL from this rotation. Those two things are completely correctable, right? You can strengthen the muscles of your lower leg and work on some neurological timing and land without rolling from the outside of your foot to the inside. And there are these, you know, the trochanters on your femur have muscles attached to them, which can hold the femur and keep it from rolling if you strengthen it properly. And the third leading cause is actually hip deceleration. So how much do the muscles of your hip attenuate the force of landing, right? How much do they break you like James Harden? A lot of people don't use their hips enough. So those are three things. There are a bazillion of them. None of the leading factors in ACL tear are in the knee. The knee's just caught in the middle. It's the forces are coming from the ground and they're coming from your torso landing, right? There's a collision here, and it's your hip and your ankle that control how these two bones meet in the middle. And if they're effed up angles or rotating, you're in trouble, right? And those are controlled from the joints above and below the knee.
Nice. What about if you think about, one of the issues that I've always kind of wondered too, especially with ACLs, I mean, if you think about like the mechanism a lot of times, right, like people plant and then it's either a twist, but then again, I've seen ACL tears where like I didn't even think that they tore their ACL. I mean, I've watched somebody put their run and they take off and then all of a sudden you see them pop up. I mean, there's no twisting. We had a guy on the podcast, I can't remember who it was years ago that, and this was purely just observational for me, but I noticed eight guys would tend to get ACL tears after big collisions and concussions. So there was, and this happened over and over again. Whenever I see a guy tear his ACL, I'd always be like, didn't that guy get knocked out like a couple weeks ago? And it was always like big collision on the left side, tear on the right. And we ended up having a guy on the podcast that actually did similar research and found that people that had big head concussions or took big hits tended to tear ACLs later on, like, you know, 2 or 3, 4 weeks later. And the idea came back to like the, you know, the neurological proprioception was slowed and they couldn't make those little micro changes as fast. And the ACL became obviously like the break and when it ended up kind of tearing with tibial slide.
I totally buy that. And, you know, actually at P3, they recently had a thing where they found that ankle sprains often precede ACL tears, right? So you lose a lot of mobility in the ankle. So maybe on your right side, you're used to taking, you know, if your ankle would traditionally flex like 30 degrees, so that means the ankle's absorbing a lot of force of landing while you're running, and suddenly it's only going 10 degrees, that force is going to go somewhere else, and often it goes to the next joint up the chain. So yeah, all of this is about the dance, right? It's this kind of beautiful human movement that happens in these super synchronous ways. It's all controlled by your nervous system and subconsciously, and the idea that we're going to like, you know, robotically improve it is never going to work, right? You're going to have to learn how to like move, you know, like.
Well, like how do we apply that over to kids? I mean, if you think about, if the first time they're having this discussion is when they come to P3 as a professional athlete, think about all like the kids that get sent to the island of misfit toys because they're all broken. I mean, you know, like, is there anything that we could, is it the shoes? Is it the training? I'm just thinking about like what simple levers we could pull to potentially make ACLs not as prevalent a thing from a younger age.
So I have half a mind to like make that the next book I work on is just kind of like, what's the, you know, what do you do with your kids? What do you do for kids? I've asked Marcus, he has 3 kids, and what he does is, he's like, hey, why don't you hop around? Like, why don't you see if you can hop like, you know, across this huge space only on your left foot and then land on your right. And he'll give him like these weird challenges while he's like working on his laptop on a Sunday afternoon. Right. Mm-hmm. And his kids get really, or he'll give him like set up some hurdles and just have him like just try to get over them or create little weird games and challenges. And, you know, he's very good at using his naked eye to see biomechanics, but he's basically looking for like, can you handle your left foot? Can you work on your right foot? And if they don't jump well on either foot, like, even at like 3, he's like, all right, like let's do a lot more on your left foot, yeah. Right? And just make them. And his kids all now are older. I think the youngest is 11, but they can. He will tell you they will easily do like ankle hops, and you can see that they're perfectly in line, and they're, you know, they're not having valgus collapse, they're not having these rotating bones. But mostly, I think it comes from just excessive physical challenges all the time, right? And like, you know, sometimes it'll be these prescribed things in the gym, and then I'm telling you, his family is constantly like, there's a mountain above Santa Barbara called Dragon's Back, which is a day's climb, and his son when he was like 10 or 11 was like, I think I could do this twice in a day, and some rich friend of Marcus's was like, I'll give you $1,000 if you can do it twice in a day. And and so they have this big family meeting about like, look, this isn't real money, this isn't the way the world works, you can't really usually get $1,000, but if you want to try it, you know, they scheduled the day. And then Marcus has this little video he sent me of here his son Kian finishing his second climb, and he's, you know, he's pretty tired, it's late in the day, and Marcus is like, hey Kian, where's your water bottle? And he's like, oh no, I left it up at the lake. And he's like, better go get your water bottle. And he's like, okay. Like, turn around and go back up and get his water bottle. Like,
nice.
It's just a lot of like every day at their house is just the idea that like your body's super well designed to take on all kinds of crazy hard challenges, and let's go.
Yeah. Well, I think people don't really realize that how unfragile they are, if that's a good word. I mean,
totally
like the thing that you can be able to do and that you can suffer through, you know, the age old, like you don't really know what, you know, what hard things you can do until you do these hard things. But I mean, there's a ton of stories about like the resiliency of like the human body and just what people are able to overcome. I mean, like literally, dude, like to this day, it probably Colin O'Brady's deal about walking across Antarctica might be the single greatest like thing that we've had on the podcast where I've been like, fuck. Like, and then there's always that thing in the back. Could I do that?
Totally.
And then you'd be like, all right, well, if somebody else has done it, there's a good chance that I could do it. And then like, I'm kind of like game planning it in my head. And, he also did another one where they were on a boat and they went from like the tip of Chile to Antarctica, which I think is called Drake's Passage.
Okay.
And it's considered like, let me pull this one up because I'm going to butcher this one too, but it's called the Drake's Passage. It's a body of water between South America's Cape Horn, Chile, Argentina, and South Shell Islands of Antarctica. And so these guys ended up rowing Drake's Passage, which was, I think, Colin O'Brady. So in 2019, a 6-passenger crew became first to cross Drake's Passage, and they did it with basically rowing. And like that was another crazy story that he told us. And I'm like, man, this guy is just like challenge after challenge after challenge. The guy that piloted it, I think was like, you know, Icelandic dude, I think was related to like Ragnar Lothbrok. He just said the guy was just incredibly focused and all he's done is these crazy rows. But I mean, it really just goes back to show like the human resilience. And, you know, we don't really necessarily know what kind of things we can do until we do hard things. And unfortunately, we're living in this kind of this fragile world where we're being taught that we shouldn't be able to do these things, but it's good.
Let me tell you here's my favorite one. This is I'm a little obsessed with this. So there's a study about how dinosaurs started to fly. And first it changed, you can see in their skull shape, their brains changed. This is in the book. So they got a flight ready brain and then they learned how to fly. But for your point about rowing across Drake's Passage or, you know, my story about, you know, paddleboarding from the Channel Islands, fuck all that. Like these dinosaurs didn't fly. And then somebody did fly. There was a first flight. Do you know how fucking ballsy that dinosaur was? You know, like, yeah, I think I got this, right? Everything that flies used to not fly. And like, they're all around us every day. You're going to see birds today.
So in the evolutionary model, I'm fascinated by dinosaurs. Like, and the fact that like, we have all these dragon stories, like every time I've ever seen like, oh, St. George slayed a dragon. I'm like, those just look like all the dinosaurs that we've ever seen. Like,
it does look like a dinosaur. You know?
Yeah. I'm like, and then it's also, weird to assume that these things would have just died out. But yet, if you look at like the Chinese, you know, the Chinese New Year with the 12 calendars, everyone's a real animal other than the dragon. Like that always felt weird. but there's also an element for birds and for things that can fly. They have hollow bones. Mm-hmm. So I'm always wondering like, if there was like the dinosaur fossils and then they found obviously the first like organism that flew, like how did that kind of evolution happen to where the bones became light? I mean, feathers, it's an interesting fucking question.
Well, people kind of think they can fly sometimes, right? Like these people in the skin suits, right? We've all got that buddy, right? Who's like, when you guys go cliff jumping, it's like a little bit less fun for that guy because he's like taking it way too serious, right? Like, anyway, I feel like there's this kind of, I mean, I used to have dreams about flying when I was a kid. I would just have like Superman, you know, just kind of dreams.
I think like, that would be the one whenever, you know, you would see these questions, be like, hey, if you could have anybody's mutant powers, I'm like flying, hands down.
Hell yeah.
Like I would never fly on a commercial flight again. I absolutely despise flying on fucking, on airplanes.
Totally.
I've been fortunate. I have a rich client that I do some consulting work for, who's got a badass jet. And every time we get on it, I'm always like, fuck. Like if fuck a Ferrari, fuck a nicer house, fuck all that shit. Yeah. Like I would just want to have a plane on go. So I never have to go through the indignity of going through the airport. You know, you like go through TSA. Situation. Yeah. The dude's like ripping your shit out. Like you go through the scanner, the guy's feeling your crotch. Like just the indignity of flying. I fucking hate, but a private plane's pretty fucking nice.
It's pretty good.
Yeah. It's pretty good.
Or Supermaning around, pretty good too.
Yeah, I just do that too. So the book came out yesterday, so we'll definitely post up some links, get people rocking and rolling. So what's next? Anything in the future, next horizons?
We're having some pretty big meetings about a docuseries about the book, actually. It's been kind of fun. But there's a bunch of stuff that I learned about human movement that is just hard to put in the written word, right? Pelvic tilt is a big deal, but it's a little hard to put in prose, you know? So we'll see how that goes. You know, it's a tough market out there for TV shows, but I do think this has a lot of interesting stuff going on around it. So that'd be kind of fun to work on that.
Awesome.
That's kind of next. And then I tell you, I love writing books. I just learned that. I didn't know that about myself, but 50, I'm publishing my first one and it's not going to be my last one. I guarantee that.
Awesome. Well, let me know when the next one comes out. We'll have you back on and we'll definitely, push this out. It's a good book and I think it's much needed. So dude, thank you so much for coming on. It was great to meet you.
Super and, fun. Really fun to talk about all this stuff. Thanks for just, I feel like you just care about human bodies and that's what I'm doing now. I got my new hobby too. Yeah.
Awesome. If people want to get a hold of the book, it's called Ballistic. I'm sure it's on Amazon anywhere. It's an easy find and they can find you on social at
henryabbott.com. I'm trying to put everything there. HENRYABBOTT.com is like, you can kind of all of the things funnel into that one spot and you can buy the book from your local bookshop on there. You can find out how to follow me on social media, all that stuff.
Awesome. Well, dude, thanks for coming. And thanks for tuning in to Power Athlete Radio. See ya. Hey there, Power Athlete Nation. Big shout out to all the heavy hitters who stuck around till the final whistle. If you've been soaking in the knowledge bombs and epic tales we've been dropping for free, here's your chance to be a game changer. Swing by klfi.com/powerathlete and toss a few bucks our way to keep the podcast fueled and firing on all cylinders. That's klfi.com/powerathlete. Your support makes a difference. See ya.
You can't rely on blind faith to get the pregnancy support you deserve. Ritual's Essential Prenatal Multivitamin is the only leading prenatal backed by its own human clinical trial. Essential Prenatal is proven to deliver key nutrients, including folate, biotin, and vitamin D during pregnancy. Get 25% off when you visit ritual.com/clinical. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Save big on everything for your next outdoor project when you shop at Menards. Greenworks 40-volt cordless tools have everything you need to keep your yard looking great. The Greenworks cordless trimmer and edger is lightweight, starts instantly, and comes with a 40-volt battery and charger. Pick one up today, on sale, now through June 1st. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save.